The test was supposed to last around 45 minutes. They would monitor her vitals, looking to see if they could get her on the verge of fainting. Initially, she would be positioned horizontal, laying face up on the table, and then the table would tilt through a series of degrees to a completely upright position. The two nurses helped her up onto the table and strapped her in, a couple of straps around her chest, a couple at the waist, and a couple at the legs. They put some electrode sensors on her chest, a BP cuff on her arm, and a pulse oximeter on her finger to record baseline readings. They went through the instructions and what to expect, and not to move through the duration of the test, to just basically let the table do the work. And so the test began, my eyes locked on the diagnostic monitor recording her vitals. After 2 minutes, the table lifted to 70 degrees of upright. They reminded her to stand perfectly still, especially her lower body, with no movement whatsoever. Almost at once, her heart rate began to increase. 2 minutes, 90 beats a minute. 4 minutes, 110 beats a minute. 6 minutes, 140 beats a minute. They asked how she was feeling at that point, and she replied that her legs were starting to tingle, and she was getting a little lightheaded. The test kept on. 8 minutes, 160 beats a minute. At this point, her legs began to tremor a little bit, and the look on her face screamed, "I'm not handling this well." And moments later, she blurted out that she felt like she was about to pass out. The nurses immediately lowered the table, exchanged a look with one another, and ended the test, only 8 minutes in. They said they would share the results with the cardiologist and be in touch in the coming days. But I already knew from the look they gave one another, it just made things even more clear. This was just the start of the storm. Have you been there? Have you been in a place where all the things you have anchored your confidence in up to now, in an instant, evaporates before your eyes, drops you to your knees? All trust and assurance in you suddenly doesn't look so solid. Maybe it was your clean bill of health. Maybe it was a great paying job. Maybe it was an identity in a significant other that's no longer there, a loss of a family member, or a friend who has now betrayed you with vicious gossip. Maybe it was a crushing blow to your social status or to your wealth. For others, you may just have come out of a storm, weathered and beaten down, torn up, but a bit more full of resolve. Or maybe you are absolutely decimated, left trying to make sense of what is left and what is in front of you. Maybe you're in a season of joy, living the good life, experiencing a stretch of abundance, knowing you are in a sweet spot right now. Make no mistake, though, whichever category you put yourself in, it is still a season, a snapshot of a larger story of your life. And much like the weather and the seasons here in Erie, the wind shifts and a sky once full of miles of clear blue and rays of sunshine quickly becomes overtaken by the ominous clouds of an approaching storm. You know, no matter the season of your soul, the book of Psalms offers us words to put to the feelings we have in the depths of our souls. It's a book rich with descriptions of who God is, the many ways his character is revealed to us, and often gives us a blueprint to use as prayers when we simply just don't have the words. You know, John Calvin wrote of the Psalms, "I have been accustomed to call this book an anatomy of all parts of the soul. For there is not an emotion of which anyone can be conscious that is not here represented as in a mirror." And so over the next 4 weeks, we're going to go on a journey through four select Psalms to learn, to unpack, and apply the poetic words contained within what is commonly referred to as the hymn book of the Bible. If you were here in January as a part of our Bible Hack series, we learned 5 keys to reading poetry, and specifically how to read a psalm. I want to encourage you that if you missed it, you can check it out as whoisgrace.com/sermon archive. Look for the Dropping Mad Bars poetry sermon by Pastor Derek for a deeper dive or a refresher. And so we're going to turn to Psalm 62 in our Bibles or on our device. Remember, it's poetic, meant to be sung as a song in that time to best hear the heart of it. And if you're like me, who can't sing worth a lick, it's probably best to read it out loud to capture the anguish and the lament and the joy and all the in-between, and to do so in its entirety. So while you are turning there, a little bit more background on Psalms. The book of Psalms is divided into 5 books, which some scholars suggest is to mirror the five books of the Pentateuch. The purpose of the Psalms goes beyond simply just expressing emotions. When read or sung in faith, they actually shape the emotions for the good of God's people. They also provide guidance in the approach to worship, calling on God's people to use their minds as well as their hearts and voices to trust in God, to more fully enjoy being in His care and stand in awe of His majesty, His holiness, His mercy, His love, and His power. You know, the Psalms have more contributors than any other book of the Bible. They name more than seven authors, five individuals that include the likes of Moses and Solomon, and two families. The largest contributor is David, who authored about half of the Psalms, 73 to be precise, and is the author of Psalm 62. So what do we know about David? I mean, can we even relate to him in this day and age? Well, here's a little what to know about David. We know he was a shepherd. We know he was a giant slayer. He was anointed to be king, and then right after that was hunted with a death warrant, after which he came to a point where he's actually appointed king. And then a little bit further down the line, he becomes an adulterer and then a murderer. And then he has this infighting of kids, with one son killing another. And that same son who killed that other son also creates a coup to overthrow Pop. And oh, by the way, he can play the harp and he writes poetry. I mean, how much comfort is that? This dude's life was a hot mess. He jacked it up all over the place. That's why I love the fact that David is the author, because of how his life went. It gives me hope for how my life has gone. And as we are going to read in a minute, this was one of the primary tools for David to put to words not only what he felt about God related to his circumstances, but it also was the platform in which he shares what he learned about God in spite of his circumstances. Okay, ready? Here we go. Psalm 62. For God alone my soul waits in silence. From Him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. How long will all of you attack a man to batter him, like a leaning wall, a tottering fence? They only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence, for my hope is from Him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be shaken. On God rests my salvation and my glory, my mighty rock, my refuge is God. Trust in Him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before Him. God is a refuge for us. Those of low estate are but a breath. Those of high estate are a delusion. In the balances they go up, they are together lighter than a breath. Put no trust in extortion. Set no vain hopes on robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart on them. Once God has spoken, twice I have heard this, that power belongs to God, and that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love. For you will render to a man according to his work. When you read that, what jumps off the page? What rhythm do you begin to see? Remember, when we read Scripture, it is so important to spend a good amount of time in observation of the text, especially with the Psalms. So asking questions like, what key words or phrases jump off the page? Where are there comparisons and contrasts being used? And when is their emphasis placed and or repetition used? And remembering that it is a poetic style comes along the need to familiar yourself with the staples of poetry. Things such as imagery and metaphor, hyperboles and more. Each style enables the readers of the psalm to enter the view of the world at that time and how it informs and shapes the emotional structure. In addition to these various techniques, the psalmists also rely heavily on parallelism. As we learned in January, parallelism is when two or more lines are put together that match or reinforce one another. When you see this used, you should pause and take note because it is trying to get you to focus in on a major idea, a major reality and truth of God. Much like when Jesus would say, truly, truly, I tell you, when he does that, you should lean in because something profound is about to come. And that's exactly what you should do with parallelism. Anyone see where this occurs in our psalm today? Right, it repeats in verses 1 and 2 and 5 and 6 when it talks about waiting in God alone. Good. Now this is when you lean in. You lean and ask yourself, why is that there twice? Why is it, what is the significance of it being repeated? What is David trying to get us to see to compare against? Which brings me to my major question I have for each of you today. When the storm hits, do you place your trust and confidence in you or him? Can we be honest with this? Seriously, let's face it. As humans, we default to self. I mean, it's embedded deep within us, a stain we just can't get rid of. It's our sin nature. If you do a quick Google search about tough times, here's what are some of the quotes that come up. Here's the first one. Accept responsibility for your life. Know that it is you who will get you where you want to go, no one else. Or how about this one? No one is going to hand me success. I must go out and get it myself. That's why I'm here, to dominate, to conquer both the world and myself. It's a head scratcher, I think, don't you? Here's my personal favorite. This takes me back to my days in playing sports. The brick walls are there for a reason. The brick walls are not there to keep us out. The brick walls are there to give us a chance to show how badly we want something. Because the brick walls are there to stop the people who don't want it badly enough. They're there to stop the other people. Pause for a second. Have you ever tried running through a brick wall? Anybody been successful on that one? I have not met one person. If you are, I'd love to meet you at some point over the next week. But do you notice a theme with each of these? It's all about you, what you can do, dependent on you, sustained by you, and made for you. Think about it. A young toddler, what do they say when you try to help them out? I can do it. Or they say, or me do. I mean, we think it's cute. And then they're learning their independence. And that's a good thing. Don't get me wrong. But at some point, when does it become dangerous? When do we get it so far along that it becomes our de facto, our go-to? And before you know it, we push God out of the way. I mean, the last time I checked, the universe that he created is not spelled with a Y-O-U at the front of it. And that's the scary thing. We can get so far down the line that we start viewing God against the backdrop of our circumstances instead of the other way around. Which brings me to the first point. Your circumstances should not dictate how you view God. Rather, your view of God should dictate how you view your circumstances. Take a look back at Psalm 62. What was David experiencing here or reflecting on when writing this? What truths about God had he discovered to resolve to this type of ideal stance to start off on about God? And then contrast it with the circumstances surrounding verses 3 and 4. Remember, David experienced a spectrum of glorious wins, tremendous defeats, and the full gamut of emotions to go along with them all. For instance, he went from being anointed by God as the next king, killing Goliath, being brought into King Saul's inner circle, the current king at the time, and then out of growing fear of David's popularity, having a death warrant on his head, which resulted in Saul hunting and chasing David all over Israel and beyond for what scholars suggest to be around 8 years. 8 years! That is not a set of circumstances that would cause me to write, "On God alone, my soul waits in silence." Or how about this one? How about the stories in 2 Samuel chapters 13 through 17? You know, I would encourage you to read them on your own sometime this week, but the summary goes something like this. At the start of 2 Samuel chapter 13, it reads this. Now Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her. And Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. So Amnon is David's son, also a half-brother to Tamar. And his cousin conjures up a plan that basically gets the two alone, and Amnon forces himself on her and rapes her. Absalom catches wind of this, and 2 years later conspires to have Amnon killed. Then he flees. But there's so much more. Absalom returns, throws a coup, and chases David out of the kingdom, and then sleeps with his dad's concubines on a roof. I mean, just like they taught you in Sunday school, right? And you thought the Kardashian family has issues right now. Listen, remember, David is described as a man after God's own heart, and the author of this psalm that describes God with words like my rock and my salvation. What did it take for the words he used to describe God to become truths he believed about God? And you get to see this wrestling of sorts, this battle within, between the truths about God and the emotions based on all these circumstances. And we see this in the first four verses, right? 1 and 2 contrasting with 3 and 4. And then David goes and places this word Selah right after verse 4. What the heck is that? I mean, what does that even mean? Well, here's a quick flyby on the word Selah. You know, many commentators think that Selah meant to pause or to reflect. This could have been a request for the reader or listener to pause and think about what has just been said. Or it could have been a space for voices to pause and for instruments to play alone. We don't really know for certain. Regardless, the word Selah itself indeed causes us to pause and consider what God may be saying, even if we don't fully get it or comprehend it or even believe it, for the reader to reflect on and contemplate. And I think David places it right here. It's like he's given us two points of view, world versus God. And then he purposely builds in this interlude, forcing those singing it to let the word sink in and to ponder, where do I see myself in this? Which brings me to the second point. It's imperative to wait in silence. Remember the significance of parallelism that we just talked about? Well, I just want us to catch the subtle difference between verses 1 and verses 5. In verses 1, it's stated as an ideal. For God alone, my soul waits in silence. In verse 5, it shifts into an imperative, which is used very intentionally. You see, an imperative is a grammatical mood that forms a command. Somewhere right now, my grade school grammar teacher is laughing at me for using that. But check it out. It's a subtle difference. Do you see it? For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence. And so it goes from an ideal to a command. The word for silence here in Hebrew is dumia, which by definition means a quiet waiting in a state of repose, which literally translates as a state of mind free from worry. So the command here is to get to a state of mind that is free of worry, which is the exact opposite of what we do, isn't it? I mean, when our circumstances become so overwhelming, what do? Well, we pray. We sit patiently in silence and wait for God to show up. No, you don't, and neither do I. I mean, can we freely admit we don't do that enough? Or is it just not okay to be real in church? We go into action mode, and the more we get caught up in it, the more we begin to think about it. And then our thoughts turn into more actions, and then our actions quickly turn into habits. And then next thing you know, you're all trying to control every little thing. And then we lay in bed at night, unable to shut off our brain, because we're worried about all that happens next. Here's the really crazy thing. Neuroscientists at Pitt have researched the impact of worrying on decision-making and cognition, and have found that anxiety actually disengages neurons in the prefrontal cortex of the brain where decision-making takes place. It literally hijacks the brain and short-circuits it. Gang, frantic activity that relies on human strength deafens the ability to hear God's voice. Let me repeat that. Frantic activity that relies on human strength deafens the ability to hear God's voice. And that's exactly what the devil wants you to do, to become frantic with worry, to fret, to be anxious, because it takes the focus off of God. Because he knows that if you busy yourself into a frantic pace with constant worrying, you short-circuit yourself and you can't stop to take the time to hear or see the truths of God all around you. That's exactly why David expands on this in his two descriptives from verse 2. Remember, the Psalms shape the emotions for the good of God's people, calling on them to use their minds as well as their hearts and voices to trust in God, even when you don't believe it. Read it over and over. Why? Well, because it's an archaic book that has no relevance to today. No, because as 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 16 says, all scripture is breathed out by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness. Because it's truth. How about think about it this way? Why would God lie about himself? But Scott, it says right here, I don't like that. I don't like what it says. Well, of course you don't. You've been looking at it from the wrong perspective, the wrong vantage point. The story has never been about you. Do you know that if we had the Bible according to Scott, it would probably be, oh, I don't know, about 20 pages or so? Of all the things I like that it says about prospering and blessings and being called an heir, not all that other stuff that talks about yielding and submitting and trusting in a God I can't see or touch. Listen, if that's you, do you really think your way, your strength, your intellect, your status, your willpower is enough to place all your trust in? Well, it's worked so far, you say. And my simple response brings us to the next point. Confidence in yourself has an expiration date. Check out verses 9 and 10. Those of low estate are but a breath. Those of high estate are a delusion. In the balances they go up, they are together lighter than a breath. Put no trust in extortion. Set no vain hopes on robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart on them. Take a look at that first one. The first one deflates any social reliance on social position. Whether you're highborn or whether you're lowborn, one is a breath, other is a lie, and in a scale they have no weight. If they're weighted together, they remain a breath. Have you ever tried weighing a breath? Take a look at the second verse. The second one deflates any reliance on status or human ability, we call gumption, and the power to control and dictate the outcomes of life. It's basically worthless. Let me ask you a question. What do you place your comfort, your trust, your security, and peace of mind in? Is it the new fad, trying the new thing because it's cool and exciting, because you're desperate to fit in? You know, crowds often lead you in the wrong direction and then leave you behind when you fall or fail or all of a sudden develop a moral compass. Where's your comfort and security then? Maybe it's comfort and security in the life you've built for yourself. The home, the job, the career, the resume, the family. You know, in some cases, the business and the accolades that accompany it. But that can all turn too, can't it? The job can be lost. The business can take a downturn. The home can be foreclosed on. The economy can implode. Then where is the peace and security? You know, or maybe you have peace and security and stability. No surprises, no shifting gears. Everything stable and secure. But all it takes is a doctor walking into the room with a worried look on his or her face, and all that changes, doesn't it? You can't do everything you once could. You can't maintain the kind of life you once had or even dreamed of retiring into. Where's your rest, security, and stability now? So where do you turn? What source of comfort and security is left? Take a look at verses 11 and 12. Once God has spoken, twice I have heard this, that power belongs to God, and that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love. For you will render to a man according to his work. Which brings me to the last point. If power belongs to God alone, our response should simply be to trust in who God says he is. And I can tell you only this. When you read that twice I have heard this, it indicates that the idea that power belongs to God is truth, and that you should place your confidence in that alone. It has been the narrative since page one of the Bible. God created the heavens and the earth and all things in it. He made man, he made woman to live in relationship with him. And then sin entered and destroyed that right relationship we were made to have with him. And from page three on, the entire story has always been about his desire to redeem you, to restore you, to seek and save those who are so distant from him because of page three, because of sin. Because of the chasm it created between him and you. And the climax of sin is that it crucified Jesus Christ, the very Son of God, who endured the ultimate form of suffering, who paid the price for you and me, and died the death we were supposed to die. It was God's ultimate sign of love for you and for me. You know, Henry Blackaby states that what you believe about God's love for you will be reflected in how you relate to him. If you really believe God is love, you will accept that his will is always best, even when it doesn't make sense. Because his ways are above my ways. You know, when we got home from the hospital after the test, I defaulted to what I had always known. Head down, roll up the sleeves, and get to work. Weather the storm with my will, with my medical background and experience, years of education, and just outlast it with my time, effort, and energy and intellect. Add on some time spent in prayer asking God to see us through, and this too shall pass. The problem is it didn't. It just kept coming. It battered us both, and I was literally left watching helpless as my world crumbled all around me. I remember walking outside into my backyard and looking up the sky one afternoon, tears streaming down my face and yelling out to God for bringing this upon us. How dare he? I had to look like an absolute fool, shaking my fists and pulling out my hair and flailing around like a two-year-old with a major temper tantrum. But boy, did I feel better after I gave God a piece of my mind, feeling justified in my action. After I collected myself, I walked back inside, and then in a matter of seconds came the sobbing. Literally brought down to my knees, overcome with trying to carry this weight under my own power. I found myself opening my Bible, my hands being guided to the story of Job, specifically Job 38. The Lord answers Scott. It was a moment I won't soon forget. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth, Scott? Tell me if you have understanding. Have you commanded the morning since your days began, Scott? Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Where is the way to the dwelling of light, Scott? The questions just overtook me. Sobbing uncontrollably, I had no answer. My confidence in myself and my knowledge and my experience, my will had failed me. And then silence. I couldn't move. And I plainly asked, what do you want me to do? Be still, wait. Those were the exact words I heard that day. And then 1 year went by. And then two. Then three. Then four. But it was an active kind of waiting, to sit at his feet and learn from him. A time where I learned so much about who he is. So many times apologizing to him for how selfish I had been and desperately opening my heart out to him, letting go of my agenda, emptying myself out on a daily basis so I could be filled with his spirit to do what he had created me to do. And then last January in the Dominican Republic on a bunk bed, me pouring out my lament to him once again, after all the refining, all the letting go, asking what was still standing in the way, he pointedly asked me this question. Why don't you trust me with your wife's sickness? Scott, how can I take it from you with your hands so tightly holding on to it? How do you respond to that? I tried fighting it, and he knew that amidst my obedience and getting closer to him, I was still holding on to that one. To stop worrying and trust him with the one person that means the most to me in this world. Take a look at verse 8. Trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. So I did. I poured it out, emptying myself once again with sobbing tears. And then I can't fully explain it, but there was this veil that was kind of lifted from my eyes. And I began to see and replay all the ways he had moved since she got sick, all the ways up to that point, ways that I was so blind to, because I was looking at it from the wrong perspective. It was that moment in my life where I went from simply seeing the words that describe God to being truths I began to understand were God. Church, does your trust and confidence rest in you or him? So my next step for you before we go into a time of Selah this morning is simply this. Read Psalm 62 as a prayer as often as you need to this week so that the words used to describe God start to become truths you come to believe about who God is. Use the words to form your prayer. Sit in silence. Use the Selah. Whatever it is, would you commit to do it every day this week? And so we're going to close with a time of reflection, a time between you and God. It may mean opening yourselves up completely to God, to pour out your fears, your weaknesses, your anxieties, your sin. All the ways that you have resolved to hold confidence and reliance on you and you alone. Take this time and pray these verses back to God, or just sit in silence. But whatever you do, whatever posture you take, reflect on these verses over and over again to begin to allow these words to shape your mind and heart, to see God for who he is and has always been, your mighty rock, your refuge, your mighty fortress, and your salvation. Love you guys. God bless.